Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together once a week here on this fine community radio station. We gather around our kitchen table. We talk about food. We talk about farming. We give recipes, advice, opinions.
Oh, lots of advice. And lots unsolicited of advice.
That's why you're here, Donna. I appreciate it a lot, and I'm sure our listeners do, too. We get help in this fine venture from a lot of folks, including
support comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974. Open daily 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op.
There's snow outside the kitchen window here, the kitchen window in the studio of KHOI.
But less than there was.
It's melting. Slippery underfoot. Watch your step out there. We had a lovely, lovely snowfall for Valentine's Day. This weekend was quite a lovely dump of white stuff. So how did you spend your weekend, Donna? Did you enjoy this wonderful snow?
Well, I did a little shoveling. It was that really light, fluffy kind that even a person of a certain age can flip the shovel around as if it were nothing.
Good. Yes, we interacted with our environment this weekend. It was very, very nice. Oh, and happy day after President's Day. In honor of George Washington, here's a news item about cherry pies. The Iowa State University's student celebration that used to be called Visha is no longer, sort of like the festival formerly known as Visha, like the artist formerly known as Prince. It's moving into our lexicon now. But they still have a tradition that they're carrying on. The cherry pie tradition lives on. And this Monday, or yesterday, I believe there was this big cherry pie to do by the people at Iowa State. And the University Department of Apparel, Events, Hospitality Management was well known for making cherry pies for the student festival, but they made some just yesterday and had a big cherry pie sale. More than 1,600 pies were sold out of McKay Hall.
Oh, if I'd known, I would have gone. I love cherry pie.
I love cherry pies, too. And I know these are little, you know, personal-sized pies, and they're quite a tradition around here. It's nice to see that that is continuing. Although, I got this information from the Sunday Ames Tribune, and a little disturbing thing here at the end of the article, it said, this is a great opportunity for students, of course, to deal with huge quantities and learning how to put out a big product there. But this year, they are relied on pre-made pie crusts instead of making their own. Well, that's too bad.
Tisk.
I'm
dummying down of the educational process once again.
I certainly hope somewhere in their studies they are going to be celebrating the joy of making pie crusts. I hope.
Well, you know, maybe it's too complex of an issue. I mean, after all, too lard or not too lard. These are issues that maybe in academics they're not willing to get into.
It's something about that. Heaven knows we have our opinions here, and
we certainly do, and they're archived, and you can listen to them if you want to.
There are pie crust opinions out there, so best of luck there. So cherry pies and Valentine's Day and white stuff falling down. We have a special guest today in the kitchen. We're going to talk bananas. With us today in the studio is Gabrielle Roche McNally. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So Gabrielle is a SUSAG student. She's getting her PhD in sustainable agriculture and rural sociology.
Correct.
This is her last year. She has a dissertation coming out on the effects of the effects of climate change on the Corn Belt. Sounds, we might have to have her back to talk about that. That's a big deal for local issue here.
It is indeed.
So Gabrielle has kind of gone bananas with a few other people here. Tell us about first of all, what the situation is that's of interest.
All right. Well, thanks again for having me on the show today. And I'll try not to bore you with too much of a long history, but just to give a little background. And the reason why we're doing this today is because yesterday, some of us in Seattle and then some of us here at Iowa State in Ames. Students at Iowa State. And then there are folks involved in a more national and global coalition. It's a loose coalition, so there's not really a name I can give it, but that are concerned with the GMO research that's being conducted on Iowa State's campus right now on a banana. The banana technology was it's first started in Queensland University of Technology in Australia, and this banana is essentially biofortified with extra beta carotene, and they're assessing the availability of vitamin A to have sort of a vitamin A enriched banana for people.
This sounds like a repeat of the vitamin A rice, which has not been at all successful, as a matter of fact, almost a 10-year period. So,
yeah, it's another way to try to simplify the process of getting people who are malnourished vitamin A. With not having enough vitamin A in your diet can lead to blindness and other health effects, and does impact people globally. So it is a real concern. Obviously, it's tied up a lot of times with other issues around hunger and broader issues with malnutrition. So this is another way to sort of address that gap. But there are people. So a year ago, I think a little more than a year ago, 120 leaders across the globe. So there are folks in Uganda and South Africa and other places in Africa. People in
working on hunger and climate justice issues, right?
Yeah.
NGOs, non-governmental
organizations, uh-huh. Yes. An organization specifically in Seattle, Community Alliance for Global Justice, who I know very well, they've been involved in sort of drawing attention to this issue. A couple other organizations I would want to just call out is Alliance for Food Sovereignty in Africa and the African Center for Biodiversity in South Africa. So they've been involved in a letter that they actually wrote to Iowa State last winter, challenging this study because they were concerned about it. This was actually the first time that a number of us, I think, living in Ames and living in Iowa had heard about it. So that was kind of what jump-started
students. We're just realizing that some of our local younger and women, it's specifically targeted at women, are being used to experiment with this technology.
So, yeah, women students ages 18 to 40 were recruited to be participants to eat these genetically modified bananas. They received $900 to do this. We obviously don't know who those people are because of human subjects research that is confidential, as it should be. And but we don't actually really know the status of the study right now. There were some problems with transporting the bananas from Australia. So I'm not aware at this time of what stage the study is in, if it's completed or not. However, there are some broader concerns. One of the concerns from this group of people who wrote this letter, they were concerned about kind of three major issues. So mm-hmm. One of them was this issue of feeding women in Iowa who are sort of more well-fed, have a much different sort of relationship to food and nutrition than most of the intended recipients of the banana. And so a lot of the people who were concerned about this said, you know, why are you feeding this to women in particular? That question's never been answered. Women of sort of childbearing age. Mm-hmm. And then why when they're so different than sort of the context of the lives that, say, in Uganda, people are – this has been sort of a target of this sort of Uganda banana variety.
Along that first point, which I think is very, very important, why would ISU be conducting this research?
So
why didn't they do it in Queensland?
Oh, because we do actually have a leading expert in this line of research. So Dr. Wendy White, and I'll stay here. I have no beefs about her or with her. She's a leading scientist in this area of biofortification. And so
she's a nutrition scientist.
Food and nutrition scientist under the College of Ag and Life Sciences here mm-hmm. at Iowa State. And she is the leading expert. And that is why, at least what we have been told, why she is the one doing this research, not finishing the research in Australia.
Okay. So ISU has obviously been gotten some funding to do this. We don't know how much. We don't really know even where the funding is coming from.
Well, Gates Foundation is funding at least a portion of this. I'm not completely clear if there are additional funding streams for this, but the Gates Foundation has been involved, and that's why our colleagues out in Seattle targeted the Gates Foundation yesterday. So they actually went to the Gates Foundation because the petition that they were delivering yesterday was actually on behalf of Credo Mobile that picked up some of the work that had been done locally and did their own national petition, and that they collected over 57,000 signatures. And that petition was targeted at Iowa State, but it was really targeting the funding structure at Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Yes, and the Gates Foundation, I believe, has a long history of funding agricultural initiatives that have to do with genetic modification, and they have been criticized quite thoroughly for it, and they still seems to be their MO. So what was the second issue that we're concerned about?
So the second issue as part of this letter was, and I'll just sort of briefly mention it here, was some issue around the health impacts of the banana. So Dr. Schubert at the Salk Institute.
Which is no lightweight. Salk Institute is a very substantial research institute.
Yes, and he's a... I'm not going to get his exact job title correct, but you can look him up. Oh, yeah, he's a molecular biologist, and he says that there are some concerns with vitamin A toxicity, even at low levels in the bloodstream. So he and others have sort of highlighted some of the issues with that. Now, I'll just point out really clearly, this is not my area of study, so I can't speak substantively to that issue, but that is one of the concerns. And then the third concern
So even given this concern, ISU and the researchers have agreed to feed these bananas to women who probably already have adequate intake of vitamin A anyway. So there are some basic health concerns about what might happen to the research subjects.
Certainly on behalf of folks who know more about this than I do, say
Dave Schubert. Well, vitamin A is well known for you can have too much and you can have too little.
Correct, yeah. But I would say that the university, and I'm not speaking on behalf of them, they would say that there aren't health concerns. But that's partly what sort of drove this letter writing and these ongoing concerns is that they haven't adequately addressed that concern.
Doesn't sound like something I'd want my daughter doing.
Bananas, they're called transgenic bananas. So these are bananas that have been genetically modified. And you say they have already been genetically modified in Queensland. And so they're going to ship them all the way to Iowa and test them here.
On young women.
On young women. And then I suppose if everything – oh, and the young woman –
who will be paid.
You'll get be paid. And then the idea is to ship more of these bananas – all over the world, elsewhere? Where do the bananas – what's the purpose of this whole thing?
The focus has been on Uganda specifically, but because Uganda uses bananas a great deal in their dietary needs, there are a great number of banana varieties. Actually, this is an aside, but I spent some time in Uganda, and it is quite incredible the amount of bananas they have. And I don't have a perfect number for you right now, but I know that there are literally hundreds of different banana varieties. And some have argued that this technology
limits biodiversity.
Yeah, yes. And that there are bananas that have more actually
naturally occurring vitamin A.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So this is the third issue. How does it not only affect ISU and the subjects, but how does it affect Uganda? How does it affect the people that will eat these bananas, but do the bananas do something to the other bananas that they're grown next to? I don't know how bananas grow myself, but it seems like one of these agricultural crops that are very important to somebody. So is this the third issue that you're concerned about?
Yeah, the third issue, and I think this is the one that as a sociologist I've thought the most about because it's more of my area of expertise, is really sort of what are the implications of the technology on Uganda and other places. I don't think Uganda is the limit.
Other banana-growing regions, yeah.
Yeah, so one, there's sort of an ecological concern potentially. Obviously, a lot of the global production of bananas is of one variety, the Cavendish variety, which is actually under threat right now, partly because it's produced in a sort of giant monoculture. We've we have sort of, through breeding technology, prioritized the global production of a banana. So I would say it's sort of this sort of trend is kind of perpetuating that sort of idea that we solve these problems based on sort of
monocropping.
Monocropping and with sort of a solution to a complex problem that could actually be addressed by a more diversified agriculture, which does exist in Uganda, and sort of and what are sort of the implications of this banana? And also there are questions of which I don't have the answer for about who owns the technology in the long term. So will that be freely available to people? Will they have to pay funds to pay the patent on it? Will it be administered through a private corporation? Who then administers that? How does that affect the biological and cultural sort of relationship people have with traditional varieties of foods?
In other words, taking this banana, bringing it to someone in Uganda, says, you should eat this banana because it's got vitamin A in it. Does that mean that they would have to pay to replace it with bananas that are just growing, have been growing in their gardens for ages?
Right, and I don't have an answer for that.
In other words, who owns this banana now? My goodness, that subject does seem to be coming up every now and then. Who owns this banana?
Well, clearly, since it's a genetically modified technique, somebody owns it.
Yes, presumably there is a patent on it from the folks in Australia, and I don't, again, know the relationship with the Gates Foundation and whether or not they have a relationship with that as well. I know that, you know, their efforts have been to sort of create technologies that are more widely accessible by broader groups of people, but I think there are real concerns because of the research and development that goes into funding this kind of research. Often people want a return on that through patents, and often a lot of private companies are involved in that. I know that we have so the UK-based Global Justice Now just did a report on the Gates Foundation, and they've said that a lot of their interventions, and this isn't specific
right,
to the banana.
Because they're not just into bananas.
Right. They're into a lot of things, and I'll note that a lot of their work has done how to make a lot of positive sort of inroads in things like polio
But particularly their agricultural endeavors in Africa for a good number of years have been focused on kind of reviving the quote, the old green revolution model, but using genetically modified techniques.
Yeah, they have a Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa, and that is sort of it's led by the Gates Foundation, but there are other people involved. I know that there are corporations that are helping to fund that work as well. And there's actually a group, the Agri Watch, which is the Community Alliance for Global Justice, and partners who have tried to sort of engage in this discussion because they've been very critical of this sort of simplified approach.
Well, the criticism from the non-GMOs about this kind of research stems from things like, okay, the UN Food and Agricultural Committee has done a fair amount of serious research that shows that actually peasant farmers empowered to grow organically or sustainably using traditional techniques and traditional seed stocks have a better chance of alleviating hunger than these large industrial GMO green revolution technologies. And the science is there showing that perhaps this is not the best approach for solving global hunger.
Right. And Amartya Sen, who's sort of written about this many, many years ago, sort of talked about sort of the major issue kind of on the tails of the major hunger and famine that happened in Ethiopia, about sort of the challenge of that issue is tied to access and empowerment and democracy. So a lot of people writing about the fact that we sort of overemphasize these technological solutions and forget
about top-down solutions.
Right.
And that goes along with it. What I've been seeing more and more is a criticism of when charity and funding comes from a lot of very wealthy private individuals, foundations like the Gates Foundation, and even though they are, let's be generous and say it's well intentioned, it's still not always the most far-sighted. People who give money have specific understandings of the way the world works that are not always that well-researched, and it is it's been called almost a colonial model of funding rather than, you know, giving the money to the UN, letting the UN do the research and, for example, the UN anyway. There are many other ways to do this, but in general, charitable giving on the large scales that we're starting to see now, it needs to be questioned.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's, you raise a really important point, and there are people who are writing about this. And I think one of the things that kind of gets missed in that is that a lot of these folks have projects that are very interesting to them, and they may be based on global priorities, but they may not, they may be sort of a pet project or a way to sort of facilitate one direction of solutions.
Absolutely.
And they bring in a lot of resources because, as you know, Bill and Melinda Gates are well connected. They have lots of rich friends and colleagues who give to that, and they do a lot of good work in the world. I don't want to dismiss that.
No, and it does come from good intention, and it looks good on paper, and maybe it's, you know, an easing of the upper class guilt or whatever, but it's definitely questionable. I mean, people who have looked at the Gates Foundation going, why are they so involved in this GM thing? Well, they made their money. They are into technology. That is their bent. That's how they see the world. And of course, it does a lot of good, but it may not fit everything.
That's true. If you're a hammer, all the problems look like a nail. So
there you
should
go.
Do it. I would like to remind folks that you are listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen, KHOI FM 89.1, Story City, Ames, and surrounding area Tasty Radio. We're back. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're going a little bit bananas here today. There's a banana issue, a GMO banana issue that
right here in
River City, Ames,
right here in Ames, Iowa, and it will affect people around the world if it keeps on going the way it's going. GMOs are kind of finding their way into lots of places. We are here in the studio today with Gabrielle Roche McNally, and she's talking about the transgenic banana that's happening is being tested, or something's going on at ISU, which sort of leads us to
banana recipes.
Well, yes. I do love a good banana cream pie.
Well,
yes,
Rick,
I do.
Our engineer, just mentioned an old standard, which was a banana with wrapped in ham and cheese melted on it. I mean, bananas, even though we don't grow them much in this country, it's so – everybody in America eats bananas.
I have read someplace that bananas are the most
The number one consumed fruit, I
number
believe.
One consumed fruit. And and people, if nothing else, people always kind of gauge their well-being by the price of bananas. If you notice that?
Mess with my bananas.
Yeah, my dad, or actually my grandparents, well, you know what I got bananas for at the store the other day? It's kind of like the price of gas. People watch. And it's true. You know? Bananas. It's true. People do pick up bananas.
And you were saying there's the Elvis Presley burger. What was that recipe?
Yeah, so I think this is, I know that Zombie Burger down in Des Moines has an Elvis Presley burger, and I believe what's on it is a fried egg, a beef patty, peanut butter, and banana. And I think this was something that Elvis liked. So I've heard.
Oh, well, that's true, because I do know for a fact that just peanut butter and banana sandwiches were probably a really good thing. It seems like it kind of.
Oh, that's a classic.
Yeah.
Didn't you grow up with that?
No.
I did. I love them with honey drizzled on top.
See? A little bit of, see? How to eat your bananas here in the Midwest. I'm sure probably Uganda has a different way of eating bananas, because bananas are not just for dessert or not just for sweet anymore. There are many kinds of bananas, plantains, that are not so sweet and are good as a fried
vegetable.
It's a good
starch. Yeah.
Good starch, yeah. Fried vegetables. Yes. Yeah. So we're thinking bananas today here on the Donna Lana Kitchen. I wanted to ask you, Gabrielle, how did this issue of transgenic bananas and, well, number one, feeding them to Iowa State women as the test subjects, and what are the consequences of that? And also, as you mentioned, the implications on other societies when these bananas are
a staple
sold to
crop,
them,
yeah.
Or being told that this is the wave of the future. We have to figure out what kind of effect this will happen. How did students at ISU have the courage to question authority on this issue?
Well, I would like to think that public universities anywhere in America and hopefully beyond are committed to the idea of academic freedom and committed to the idea of critical dialogue around issues that impact our lives and the lives of people living elsewhere. And I think Iowa State and students at Iowa State, a lot of them graduate students in the program in sustainable agriculture, we like to sort of question some of the dominant paradigm thinking about technological solutions. And I think in a good way, in a way that one is supposed to, at least that I was trained to do work in pursuit of sort of knowledge. So how are technologies used? Who benefits from those technologies? So a group of students last year found out about this. We found, oh my gosh, 120 people from all around the world wrote a letter to the dean of College of Ag and Life Sciences and to Iowa State, and they said, we're really concerned about this technology. And we thought, okay, well, one, we haven't heard about this, and two, we're concerned about it too as engaged members of our student body. What is this? What's going on with this technology? So we actually put together, and this is going back in history a little bit, but March of last year in 2015, we put together a dialogue, and that's really what kicked this all off, a transgenic banana dialogue. And we invited members, so we invited Dr. White, who's the lead researcher. We invited Dr. Ruth McDonald, who is the chair of, the Food and Nutrition Science Program, and Dr. Dean Winterstein. And we encouraged them to be a part of this panel. We also included a student, Naboth Mumbwale, who's now doing his PhD, but he is a sustainable ag student who is from Uganda and has also done research on food insecurity issues and had a lot of insight from his own experience. We invited Dr. Clark Wolf, who's thought a lot about ethics in agriculture and in research. And then Dr. Christina Gish Hill, who's studied a lot about food sovereignty, mostly within a U.S. context. So we wanted to have this dialogue about sort of what are some of the broader questions that one might have about this research, not just is it safe or not, since we didn't actually have anyone on our panel who could speak directly to that issue, but what are these other sort of questions and concerns about who owns the technology, how it will be used, how it will impact food insecurity and food sovereignty in these other countries, and that we thought these are questions that a public university who's engaged in research ostensibly for the public good should be able to answer. Sadly, the administration did not want to participate in the dialogue, and so we still went forward. And that is actually on our website, a recording of it, isutransgeticbanana.com, just a website that students put together. We paid for it ourselves. And we put it together to just highlight this issue. The event had maybe 80 people. I can't entirely remember.
Lana and I were there.
Yay.
Yes.
And hopefully you can attest to the fact that it was a very respectful and thoughtful discussion. And that's what we wanted. And I think a lot of people were there were saying, you know, why aren't there people from the other side? I'll just say that. Here. And we didn't have a really good answer except that they didn't want to participate. And over time, I will say that we've kind of been painted a little bit in sort of this corner of antagonizing the administration or antagonizing the researchers. You know, that's never been our intention. Our intention has been to broaden the dialogue on this important issue. And again, to have a conversation, because biotechnology is alive and well in this country. It's a technology that's widely used on our corn and soybean acres across the entire Corn Belt. And but there are ecological and health concerns and sort of ownership of the technology concerns that people have. And we should be able to have a discussion about those things. No technology is benign or evil, right? Technology and how we use it and who owns it, those are nuanced conversations. So as students, we wanted to have that conversation and expand that and to continue to highlight this issue, because we thought it was something really important that there are people from Uganda and South Africa writing about what's happening on our campus. We thought, that's important. Someone should be acknowledging that. And to my knowledge, the administration and the university has never acknowledged that letter and never sort of broadly sort of responded to some of these critiques in a public way. They did write a letter to the editor in the Ames Tribune this, I think it was August or September this last year, and they did note that they
and
were.
And that was Ruth McDonald, the department chair, and Wendy Winterstein, the dean of ag.
Right. And they basically just said that they defended and supported their researchers, of which they should and can, but didn't really address the broader issues that we were bringing up. And we were disappointed that we couldn't sort of have more of a dialogue as we've been trying to have.
Dialogue is important. And to restate again, a group of concerned students, they delivered a petition to the College of Ag and Life Sciences at ISU.
Yesterday.
Yesterday. And 57,309 signatures on that petition.
And it was also delivered to the Gates Foundation.
Correct.
Yesterday. And any response, or what was your reception?
So we just had a really small gathering here at Iowa State of students who are interested in the issue, and we dropped off the petition. So this was the petition that we dropped off yesterday was Credo Mobile. They did a petition, and they've generated.
Right. This is getting national media attention.
Correct. Yes. And so they did this petition. So we offered to deliver the petition on behalf of them. And then at the same time, folks out in Seattle with the Community Alliance for Global Justice and partners also delivered the petition to the Gates Foundation. As to my knowledge, there has been no formal response. Yesterday, we just delivered it to Dean Winterstein. She was not in our office, so we left it with her secretary. And that's about all. We took a photo, and we want to continue to highlight this issue. Obviously, there is global interest in this issue, and I think it was important for us to do that. And I know that out in Seattle, they're continuing sort of an ongoing campaign to challenge some of these issues with the Gates Foundation. Mm-hmm. So that's part of this sort of broader conversation that they're having. But I don't know what impact the petitions will have. But I do think at the very least, it sort of highlights the fact that people, you know, here in Iowa, but also further afield, are concerned about some of the research that's being conducted here, and that, you know, I think Clark Wolf kind of said this in our transgenic banana dialogue, you know, sort of the fact that researchers should be able to pursue interesting scientific questions, and that these are part of our role as scientific, you know, institutions to do that work. But we also have sort of an opportunity and a privilege to sort of engage in a conversation about the use and application of that and to challenge some of the ways that public dollars or public and private relationships are conducted in a way to serve these other benefits that may not be beneficial to others in other parts of the world, and that we should be able to ask those kind of ethical questions, often because the justification for these studies are based on sort of we're feeding people, we're feeding the world, we're feeding starving people in other countries, and it takes a very sort of a moral high ground. And we're not against feeding people in the world. That is a really wonderful thing, but we can disagree about how best to do that.
Well, that is a common cultural meme that you hear in Iowa a lot. Oh, we're feeding the world. Now, once again, that has actually been quite disproved. It seems that starving people are caused not by lack of food, but by distribution issues, disparity in where the food is sent and who has what. So, you know, it's a PR tactic. Let's feed the world. That sounds good. And then didn't you say you'd been sort of painted as a group wanting mothers in Africa to starve or something like that?
Yeah, so after our, what I'll say, very respectful actions, if you can call it an action, we delivered a petition yesterday respectfully in Seattle. They did the same. After that, there were some pictures that were posted from both of those events on Twitter and Facebook, and those have been taken by folks working in the pro-GMO lobby, I'm calling them, because there are a lot of folks who are very concerned about critiques about biotechnology. And so they've taken memes, so they've taken pictures of us and put words around it. We call them, you know, memes. And basically some of them have – so accused a group of us here at Iowa State of using our white privilege to sort of get in the way of addressing people who are starving and hungry in other countries. In Seattle, they accuse people of, wanting, like, Ugandans to go hungry or to go blind. And, of course, that's really insulting for those of us who work in this world, work in this realm and who care a great deal about.
You're a sociologist. Who would know better?
So that's just part of – I bring that up really to highlight the fact that there is an online presence of people who are very voracious in their critique against anyone who challenges the technology.
And let's say that those people are quite well paid by the industry that profits from this technology. Let's make no mistake about the money behind that side of the PR information or disinformation campaign. It's serious.
Yes, absolutely. So Kevin Folta is someone who's been on Iowa State's campus. He's a researcher at the University of Florida, and he writes a blog and has been very involved in sort of this public campaign to inform people about how good biotechnology is and how we should all accept
it. Yes, and his funding has proven to be come seriously from the industry that he's supporting. Hello, is this a theme?
He challenges that, but the New York Times did a big piece on that because they had done a Freedom of Information request and tried to look at the linkages of how he's been influenced. And again, I think our critique, I don't have a critique of individual people. It's really about the fact that there's no room to have a reflexive sort of discussion about these issues and how does that determine then how we allocate resources and do research, and the fact that a lot of these people attack individuals who are not paid, students who or individuals who work for small
nonprofits.
Yes, exactly.
How much are you being paid to do this?
Yes, zero. And I'm not making any money off of this. And as students, do work on Facebook. If you're going to put an ad on Facebook, you know, that's our own money. And most of our work hasn't cost any money, right? It's just been doing outreach and putting on events.
Well, it takes a lot of time.
Yes. I applaud you for asking questions. We should all ask questions. If people want more information about this sort of thing, is there a website or how do they contact you and your organization?
So I would tell them to go to the ISUTransgenicBanana.com and we could also share some resources on the KHOI website, if that's possible, to link there. I think that's a good place to get started. We've got a resource page that people can do more research on. Mm-hmm. We're writing some more stuff about this that we'd like to publish more broadly, just to sort of expand this discussion on this issue.
That's great. That's great. Let's set bananas aside for a small bit here, although keep that in the back of your mind, everybody. Think about bananas. Think about bananas around the world. I know Gabrielle as also a cook. She makes lots of good things. She can relate to food very well. And earlier this winter, you gave me a really good pumpkin soup recipe. It's pumpkin soup with chutney. And I really like this recipe because pumpkin soup, it's great. It's good for you. There it sits. But the chutney that you added to the whole thing was really tasty. Do you have anything you'd like to say about this recipe?
Yeah, I'm assuming that will be on your website.
We'll be sliding right into the website. Yeah, recipes and lots of other things can be found at khoifm.org. That is the radio website. You can go to the talk section, go to the Donna Lana Kitchen section, and we have a recipe page there. And this one will soon be there. It's called Pumpkin Soup with Chutney. Anything you'd like to say about that?
Yeah, so I borrowed this from Rachel Ray, or I modified it from Rachel Ray, I love that about recipes because they're constant, like, iterative process of improving them and adding your own flair to it. And recipes are, you know, if you look at a lot of these online blogs, they'll say, I took this piece from, you know, X person and this piece from Julia Child or whoever. So I love that about it. So, I was really excited by that chutney piece for the same reason that you kind of brought up that, you know, pumpkin soup is nice, but sometimes it's like, it's hard to get a lot of dimensions in the flavor.
It just tastes so good for you that there it is.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm looking at the recipe, and I'm just going to quickly go over it. Pumpkin, or canned pumpkin even, and I like to use, of course, instead of pumpkin, I love to use the kabocha squashes. Chicken stock, cream, butter, olive oil, celery, onion, garlic, nutmeg, thyme, parsley, cayenne, pepper, salt, and pepper. Okay, that's fairly classic, but then underneath it is this chutney that just sounds delightful. Tart apple, cranberries, lemon, orange zest, salt and pepper, and grated ginger. Yep. It sounds really good.
Yeah, it's really good. It's got a good tart flavor. And it's a nice way to do something with cranberries, right, that we often forget what we mm-hmm. can do with cranberries beyond, like, the traditional holiday meal. What's nice about this, it was reminiscent of a Thanksgiving meal, like, all in one bowl, too. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be served around that time, so we should be eating squash all the time. And then one thing that's not on there that I like to do is put a little, like, balsamic reduction on there to just sort of give a little tart sweetness. It's a nice addition.
Yum. Yum.
So, and I know, Donna, you're a cook, so I'm sure you might have some ways to modify that.
this sounds really good to me.
Yes, yes. There's lots of good things to come out of kitchens.
Okay, so we're going to post that recipe for
yes,
you guys
we will.
To try because we are still in the cold winter soup period of season here.
Yeah. Donna has a recipe to share, but first, a tune by a group called Red Molly. They came through Ames as part of the Blue Stem concert series last year, and they're doing a song by a little blues man named Robert Johnson, and it's his tune, but they've kind of tweaked it for three women's voices and for the women's point of view. It's called "Come On Into My Kitchen."
You better come on, come on in my kitchen, come on, 'cause it's going to be raining outdoors. Girl, you're in trouble, that man put you down. You know I can't stand to see you pushed around. You better come on, come on in my kitchen, come on, 'cause it's going to be raining outdoors. You don't have a dollar.
You don't have a dollar.
You don't have a dime.
Don't have a dime.
Well, come on over, girl. You can borrow mine. You better come on, come on in my kitchen. Come on, 'cause it's going to be raining outdoors.
This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. That was Red Molly. Group of three women in the kitchen. There's three women in the kitchen today here, too. We're here with Gabrielle Roche McNally. I'm Lana Noctegull, and there's Donna Prisgintis. Donna Prisgintis, what's cooking?
Well, something I've been attracted to this week is my bones are a little cold, is, you know, heavier, first of all, of course, a lot of soups. But my friend Susan Herman Loomis, who has a cooking school in France called En Roux Tatin, sent out a recipe that was really appealing to me. And I thought, oh, this is, would be so good for Iowa. It's called, she is American, but it's called choucroute, which is really the French word for sauerkraut. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about sauerkraut for its probiotic uses and that sort of thing. But here they actually rinse and cook the sauerkraut. So, of course, it's going to kill the probiotics in it. But, boy, it sure is yummy. It's a classic French dish where you take the sauerkraut and you rinse it to get the saltiness out. And then you actually cook it with onions and apples in white wine. And then you serve it. You also add cloves, juniper berries, bay leaves, garlic. Then you serve it with knackwurst, frankfurters, smoked sausage such as kielbasa, potatoes, and bacon. Well, now, doesn't that sound like a very Iowa thing? We could do that. Her recipe is at her site, En Roux Tatin, onruetatin.com. That's Susan Herman Loomis. And she's a wonderful writer, so she gives a good description of it. And then, of course, the recipe. So, you know, think sauerkraut and pork. We could do that.
Oh, a nice French recipe.
Yeah, and the nice part is that she sticks the apples and the onions in it. I think that really perks it up a lot.
Yeah, and the idea of rinsing the sauerkraut first. To get, is that some of the extra salt or the extra – does that kind of – mild it up a little bit?
Yes, it does. It'll sweeten it up. And I mean, you know, sauerkraut is a preservation method for cabbage, right? So this probably comes from maybe Alsace-Lorraine or someplace like that, more in the Germanic parts of Europe. And so, you know, you do need to have some of it for its probiotic effects. But you also, if you want to eat more of it, you can clean up the flavor a little bit and slide it into some more traditional dishes here. And this one sounds yummy to me. Anything with bacon, sausage, potatoes, sauerkraut, you know. How bad can that
be? What's not to like?
It's a winter dish.
That's very good. And that reminds me, the French word for cabbage is choux, C-H-O-U-X,
yeah.
Choux. And harkening back to Valentine's Day, if I remember my French correctly, choux is a term of endearment.
So mon petit choux, my little cabbage.
Yeah, so we may call somebody a honey bunch here, but boy, you ought to consider yourself well-blessed if you're called a cabbage.
Yeah, or another nickname would be chouchette.
Oh, little.
Yeah, my little cabbage, chouchette, is it. Sometimes you'll call a little girl, oh, chouchette.
Oh, good. So that's a good thing to remember for cabbages. Yeah, good. Chouchou, that's good. Thinking of garden things to come and gardens past, here we are.
Oh, aren't we hopeful? Oh, we have to be hopeful.
Well, you know, this is the time of seed catalogs.
I think it's all going to melt next week anyway. Hooray! Hallelujah!
Lyra, thinking a little early there, but I think it'll be good. I'm thinking of something that I had the presence of mind to do late last summer, and I always talk about this and you read about this. I actually got myself together and gathered together herbs that I've been growing, and I dried up a bunch of those, and I've been using them for tea all winter. And I learned something this year. In the past, I've dried my little jar of maybe sage. I've dried my little jar of anise hyssop. I've dried my little jar of mint. And making tea out of just one of those was always a little too much. So I just said, okay, we're going to have a mélange, a mixture of a bunch of stuff.
Lana has gone into the blending business, I can tell.
So I just picked all of this stuff, and I dried it, and it turned out real well because there's some things I've never put in before.
Well, give us the recipe.
Here it is.
Oh, boy.
So I've got some jars of this, and it's been a really good green tea. Holy basil, the Tulsi basil, orange mint, pineapple sage,
Oh, good use for pineapple sage. Yeah, yeah.
Black currant leaf.
Oh, yes. I'm big on that one.
And raspberry leaf. That's supposed to be really
very
good.
Classic.
And lemon balm.
Oh, yes. Classic flavors.
I'm sure those you gardeners out there, all this pretty stuff is growing. You've planted all this stuff because you want to attract the bees. You want to have nice things. You can break off any of these and use them fresh.
And they all grow really well.
They grow really well. Yes. I especially enjoyed the orange mint this year. And this year was the first year I grew a lot of.
Orange mint. Did you start that from seed? Where'd you get orange mint?
Where did I get orange mint?
I don't believe I've had orange mint.
Oh, I got that. Where did I get that?
Does it come up? No, I
bought that from a farmer's market vendor someplace or the other, I remember.
Okay, so.
And yes, it does come back.
So it'll keep coming up.
Yes,
so we'll have it again this year.
Okay. Anyway, think of, now next fall, just put this on your calendar. And do gather this stuff kind of early September-ish so that everything is still
succulent.
We'll
remind you again.
Right. It's a good thing to do. You've got green stuff and mix things together. Like I said, one by itself, especially lemon balm. I've tried lemon balm before. That's also in the mint family, but it's a little sharp when you just make it by itself. Mix all that stuff together. It was really good. I used a food dryer. I have an electric food dryer to dry everything fast. I suppose you could just hang things up, but I like to do things fast, get it in a sealed container. And I've been enjoying that. It's a nice, you can be ever so smug. It's your very own winter
brew, right?
Brew.
I mean, you
there
can only drink so much coffee and hot chocolate without getting really deranged.
There we are. There are some upcoming things. You mentioned, Donna, you are headed to a thing called Moses. What is Moses?
Midwestern Organic and Sustainable Education something.
Symposium,
perhaps?
I can never remember exactly what Moses stands for.
but just Google capital M-O-S-E-S. It is at the end of the month, and Mary Swander and I are going with Joe Lynch, and we're going to launch our Ag Arts group, and which is a whole other thing that we'll talk about sometime. But Moses is the largest organic farming conference in the world, and it's in
La Crosse,
Wisconsin, and it is oodles of fun. One of the things I love about it is that wide-ranging ages that show up, lots and lots of young people, and then lots of us old farts that have been organic farming for 40 years and stuff like that, and great dancing, great presentations. Mary Swander's going to present Map of My Kingdom up there. And they also, it's a huge conference. I can't remember. Well, Joe and I will give a report when we get back, but they managed to feed everybody organic food for the whole time. It's a two and a half day conference. And we'll be reporting when we get back.
Very, very good. And also, this next coming Monday, there is a reading at the Ames Public Library.
At the library.
Monday, February 23rd. Of the new book coming out by Taylor Broby and Stephanie Brooktrout called Fracture, a fine book.
It's a compilation anthology, and some of the authors who are from Ames, like Carolyn Raffensperger, are going to be reading at that. So that's Monday, 7 o'clock at the Ames Public Library. Do come.
They'll be good. You've been listening to the Donna Luna Kitchen. We've learned a lot about bananas and ISU's connection.
Political implications.
Our implications around the world when we start doing things to our food. We've had our guest in the studio today, Gabrielle Roche McNally. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Good. We'll go out with some music by Seamus Begley and Stephen Cooney, some Irish music. Well, this is for those of you who listen for this sort of thing, this is a hornpipe, which will slide into a slide. Slide is also a kind of tune, so we'll listen to that. Earlier we heard the group Red Molly with Come On In My Kitchen. Oh, yes. KHOI is community radio. Support this fine station. We're all in this together. Go to khoifm.org to find out more. And find our website there. Look for the Donna Luna Kitchen. Let us know What's on your plate? Recipes, advice, opinions, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us at khoiradio@gmail.org. My name's Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering, as usual, by Rick Morrison. Eat good food. Enjoy life.